It's very simple and practical from a public sector perspective. And these slides, which are also quite simple, were made by three of my students in the other drug war this last summer who worked together. And the students all teach the last class of the course. And this particular group, they've been doing this on the basis of an article. I had Hillary, Joanna, and Anna Wells. They had to create an animated, engaging exercise to teach people about this in the class. And so what they did is they baked cookies. And they had cookies that were TB cookies, and they had cookies that were ARVs for people that had HIV, and they had malaria cookies. And they broke us up into little groups, and they gave us different amounts of money because we were from different countries. And they gave us lists of our drugs and how much our drugs cost, and if we bought more of some of them, if we had more volume, we'd get lower prices, et cetera. And some countries had enough money to buy all the drugs they needed, as the United States does, and others didn't. So this is about collaborating across boundaries, whether it's national boundaries or within a country across geographical and bureaucratic administrative boundaries. The paper is based on a literature review and selected stakeholder interviews. The focus is on four established models that work across countries, two of them working within the UN system: the Global TB Drug Facility, which does just TB drugs, the Pan-American Organization, the Revolving Fund for Immunizations, the Gulf Cooperation Council model, and the Organization of Eastern Caribbean States Pharmaceutical Procurement Service, which is working with nine small countries. And this particular one I actually set up 23 years ago, and it's been running self-finance, no foreign aid, no technical assistance ever since I left it in late 1989. There's a lot of gray literature on pooled procurement, which is, I think, misleading, because people get tangled up in the mechanics of how the procurement is done and different ways of doing procurement and not in the benefits of pooling procurement. So the learning objectives here are to identify some of the key potential benefits and describe the advantage of establishing a consolidated buying mechanism within a regional or public institution. This second point is something that was enlightening to me as I thought about it. What is it? Consolidation of purchasing power. Not volume, although volume happens, but purchasing power. It's like if a lot of housewives go together and decide to buy all their flour collectively, they're a bigger market segment. What are the benefits? Reduced unit purchase prices. The purchase prices in the Eastern Caribbean went down over 50% when we introduced the system back in 1986. 1987 was the first time it worked. Improved quality assurance. I'll talk more about that, but these students who made the cookies had some cookies that were broken, and substandard cookies that people got, especially the people that were working on their own, so they didn't have any preventive measures to make sure they didn't get corrupt or substandard suppliers of cookies. Reduction of corruption. Rationalized selection and standardization when you're working together and trying to rationalize things. Economies of scale in the administrative costs. Increased equity between members. Some of the gray literature suggests that this is a problem. You know, that you are helping the smaller or weaker players by having larger players involved. Strengthened host institution and improved supply chain management, just because other improvements are usually inspired. It's the formation of a monopsony, which in economic terms mean the buyers have gone together. Instead of the sellers being a monopoly, you've got the buyers going together, so they're controlling a certain segment of the market, and it gives them more power. So the suppliers are then competing for the contract, not just volume, but they're competing to maintain or get that market segment themselves. Framework rather than bulk purchasing, this is very important. Any of these mechanisms use a year or sometimes an 18-month contract where the suppliers are told not a guaranteed quantity usually, but that you will get all of this market over that period of time, and that's what you're bidding on. So the contracts are guaranteed, are granted based on price, usually, and not other influences, like the influence of marketing and suggestions about what products to use or anything that a drug company can do to get people to buy from them, including under-the-table payments in developing countries. Some of the benefits, transition to restricted tendering. I think this is why there's some confusion in the gray literature. When you do this pooled procurement, it usually means that your whole procurement mechanism is improved. So people do restricted tendering, by which I mean they pre-select suppliers to make sure that they've got good quality suppliers. And they don't just run an ad in the newspaper and let anybody, whether it's Chinese or somebody who invented a company, which happens, bid. They have to have been pre-selected, which takes more time the first time round, administrative costs included, but then is more efficient later because you're not dealing with as many suppliers. So screening prevents counterfeit, substandard drugs, increased transparency, why you are allowed to even bid. Screening should, I say should, have to have some honesty in the system, eliminate corrupt suppliers. It encourages reputable suppliers. In some countries I've worked in, reputable suppliers don't even want to get into the government system because they know that they won't win the contract if they're not making some sort of under-the-table payment. The people running this system have to receive adequate salaries to minimize their vulnerability to corruption. Here I'm, again, mostly focused on developing countries. Rational selection and standardization. The fact you have all these groups working together forces them to talk more about what they should or shouldn't buy, everything from better therapeutic choices based on generics if they're available, the best treatment, to rationalizing the pack sizes so you don't have too much variety and you have less volume. I mean more volume for the things you're picking. The collective commitment of partner countries, political capital, leads to more standardization and other kinds of collaborative behavior. You could imagine if it was a lot of housewives who went out and talked about what they'd got. Collectively, they could talk about whether things were too close to the sell-by date, whether they had some short packaging, you know, not just the actual quality of the pharmacological entity, but other aspects of performance, quality performance, that people share their experience and talk about it so they get rid or they don't award as much to suppliers that don't do as good a job. Barriers to successful pool procurement, language across national boundaries, politics, people want to have their own system, geographic distance. I looked at the 9 Pacific Island countries for the bank a few years ago in this area. Stability of national monetary systems when you're working across boundaries. Lack of information. Some people can plan their whole procurement, how much they need, what they need much better. And most importantly, the influence of the pharmaceutical industry, which really wouldn't want this to happen. They're better off with a system that's fragmented. However, it's important, despite those barriers, to focus on the benefits when you're working with policymakers and not emphasize these potential barriers, because most of them can be overcome. Nevertheless, it's necessary to be aware of them. Who uses pooled procurement successfully? These are the 4 agencies I talked about. Gulf State started in 1978, moved on. It basically buys vaccines, drugs, other medical supplies for 7 Persian Gulf states, and it works well. They've set this up together. This system is well known. It started way back in 1979, and it's now providing to almost 40 Latin American countries. It's well known that the vaccine prices through the PAHO system are quite low, probably the lowest in the world for products usually, and that the quality assurance is excellent. OECS, this is the 9 small countries that I had worked with, still going strong after 23 years. They've moved on to regional formularies, some drug studies, other kinds of things. The alliance has allowed them to build other kinds of skills and interventions in the pharmaceutical sector, just through the pooled procurement, which is, and that's the source of the funding for them. The Global TB Drug Facility, this was in some ways created to get people to use the right therapies in drugs, to guarantee, make sure that they were getting good suppliers, and they work through two mechanisms. One is if you get a grant from them, you have to buy your drugs through their pooled procurement, but even without a grant from them, you can go through them and purchase your TB drugs. And again, as with the PAHO system, they're pre-qualifying suppliers. They'll also tell people they can go directly to these suppliers, so they have a white list of who's good, and they give advice on what the therapies should be. This is from the Global TB. One of the things that was most striking to me as I was doing this review is the issue of ownership, which I had not thought about before, because I had worked with these very small countries in the Eastern Caribbean. The politics of getting everybody to work together was very complicated, and we always knew that if one country was unhappy and dropped out, we would run the risk of having a domino effect, especially in the early years. So trying to keep all the 7 ministers of health for the initial system happy, who are all bit prima donnas and things like that, made it more difficult to do, and lots of other things that made it difficult to do. As I looked at these UN systems, I realized how it's so much easier to work through an existing organization if you can, and it gives some of our UN organizations a more practical value when they're often seen as not very forward-thinking think tanks. So the practical things that are done with the TB group working through WHO with PAHO are very useful. And in fact, the Eastern Caribbean one is set up under a sub-regional organization. So this business of ownership and trying to get countries to create a new organization really complicates things and is unnecessary. I was also struck that UNFPA has an excellent system for contraceptives, and yet they don't market it. Everybody, a lot of people say it's the best part of UNFPA in Latin America and North America, but they feel, the countries feel they should have their own system. So the notion of going through a regional or a global body makes people feel that as a nation state, they aren't strong enough, that they should be able to do it internally themselves. And I think that's misguided thinking, especially for very small countries. I think I've covered most of these kinds of things, exclusive and non-exclusive participation, because you're trying to guarantee a segment of the market to the suppliers that want to bid. This is important, how much people are buying through them. But with the regional and global institutions, I think that's working more and more, because if some countries drop out, there are still others there. And I don't want to cut the time of my other presenters short, so I'm just going to skip over some of these mechanisms for payment, volume or value commitments. We don't guarantee quantities or dollar amounts in most of these systems. And the ultimate goal is access to good quality pharmaceuticals and vaccines to people. I'm going to move through the presentations, and then we'll have time for questions and answers at the end of this. We're going to have a presentation from Brenda on reducing corruption in the purchase of ARVs. Unfortunately, she couldn't come because of a health problem in the family. So our next presenter is Dr. Jack Solomon, who's from Medical Care and is a professor of health policy and administration at the University of Chicago. He's also worked, Illinois, at Chicago. and he's worked in both the public and the private sector. And he has a doctorate in medical care organization and administration, and an MS from the Sloan Program in Health Services Administration. And he and I have become quite active colleagues, mostly over the internet, the last 4 years maybe. So he's one of the movers and shakers that come out of medical care section. Jack?